Hello and welcome to This Is Modern Rock, the podcast that usually takes a month-by-month look at the modern rock charts. But today, as part of our 1993 season wrap-up, I've got my good friend Jeremy T. back on the show.
Hello.
Hi, Jeremy. How's it going?
Great.
Well, we'll call this our Bubbling Under episode. This is tradition for us now, where we talk about songs that did not chart on the modern rock charts, but that we think are worth drawing attention to. And all of these songs are going to be from 1993 as well. So I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. Can't wait.
I've chosen three songs. I let Jeremy choose three songs. And I think we've got a good variety of styles and artists here.
Yeah, and you haven't told me what you picked, so I'm looking forward to being surprised.
Yeah, I remember last season you brought in some stuff that I was unfamiliar with, and there was some really cool music that I appreciated a lot. Well, before we jump into it, let's do a mystery achievement. This is where we listen to a song that may be unfamiliar to listeners, usually from the lower reaches of the charts. So, Jeremy, I picked out one special for you.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you anything about it other than it's from 1993, and there is possibly a slim chance that you're familiar with this, but probably not. So let's give it a listen and let's see if you know what this song is.
Tell me why I love you. You never became like a child. You never gave me nothing. You only stand by your side. So tell me why I love you. Tell me what is over. There's a good strong earth, it's raining on my blood. Oh, love you, Susie, send me to the west. Ride this, Susie, ride. You know you lay me down to rest, rest, rest. Chomp, 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 chomp. Chomp, 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 chomp.
That one's pretty obscure. So, Jeremy, I'm going to give you an incredible 11 points, if you know what that is.
I have no clue. I liked it, though, a lot, though, actually.
Yeah, I like that, too. It brings a smile to my face every time I hear it. It's short, which we all know I love, and full of energy and lots of fun. Other than the fact that I like this song, the reason I chose this is because this is from a Spanish band, and I know that you spent some time in Spain in your younger days.
Wow.
The band's called Australian Blonde. And the song is called Choop Choop, which translates
suck,
to what
suck.
Now? Suck Suck.
Yeah.
The band's led by Francisco Nixon. Australian Blonde was one of the leading bands of what the Spanish music press dubbed the Xixon sound, Xixon. How would you pronounce
it? That's close.
Okay, we'll call it Xixon sound. You know, I dug up a few articles here and there, and there were comparisons to, like, the Seattle grunge thing, not in that it sounds like grunge music, but it was like this city in Spain that a whole bunch of cool music exploded out of all at the same time.
Those are Spaniards?
Yeah.
Huh.
They are indeed. I think if you listen carefully, you can maybe get the sense that English is not their first language, but it's not super obvious.
I noticed an accent, but I thought it was like they had a cold or something. I didn't identify a country.
There's just such big slackers that they can't be bothered to pronounce words correctly.
Yeah, they needed a spit before singing and they forgot to.
Yeah. That song, Choop Choop, it comes from the band's 1993 album, Pizza Pop. And I think in Spain, it appeared in a Pepsi commercial at some point, which helped propel them into some kind of mainstream over there.
Wow.
All right, well, let's move into our actual picks for the episode. Jeremy, do you want to kick things off?
Sure. Let's go with Pulp, maybe.
I'd love to talk about Pulp.
I think they're the most accessible of what I brought to the table.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a Pulp expert. I learned about them way after the fact from my wife, who's a Pulp mega fan. But I like them a lot. In fact, all this music, 93 to me is the foundation of my indie roots, but I grew those roots around 98.
Okay.
I was oblivious as a 13-year-old when this music came out. Didn't know any of these bands. But if you look at my collection, it really starts kicking in around now.
Any idea how many albums you have from 1993?
130, I think.
Ooh, okay. I think I've got about 60 or 70. So we're pushing 200 between us, although I'm sure there's some overlap there.
Yeah. So Pulp is a, you know, British band from Sheffield, England, led by Jarvis Cocker. They'd been a band since 1978. Their first album came out in 83. Their early sound was kind of like Leonard Cohen folk meets Scott Walker meets just kind of wimpiness. But I actually really love that music, and a real goth tones too. But it sounds nothing like the Pulp that became famous.
You know, why don't we listen to Pulp's first single first?
Yeah.
And then we can, you know, hear the change. You said this one's from 1982. Is that right?
I thought it was 83.
83,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is called My Lighthouse.
Yep.
Pulp's first single.
I just wanted to bring you up here so you could have the chance to see the beauty of this situation that you could share with me. It may seem strange to talk of love and their lighthouses. It's not strange to me.
I think that's recognizable as Pulp, mostly because of Jarvis Cocker's voice, but you're right. It doesn't sound like the later era Pulp that we're going to hear in a minute.
Yeah, it feels acoustic guitar based, and a lot of their early stuff was even more mellow than that. But I think it's really instructive to see how far they went, even though I'm a defender of early Pulp, but it's not the Brit rock sound we know. My Lighthouse and all their early material came out on Fire Records. They put out a few albums, an EP, some singles. Then they were on Gift Records. And then they moved on to their major label, Island, I think it was. Razzmatazz was a non-album single, but for US listeners, it was put on their His and Hers album. And it's on their greatest hits as well. But it is not on the original His and Hers. It's just a non-album single. Can we listen?
Yeah, here we go. So I guess 10 years after...
Yep, 10 years after the previous.
Here's Razzmatazz.
He's always sleeping with your mother, and I know that your sister missed her time again this month. Am I talking too fast, or are you just playing dumb? If you want, I can write it down. It shouldn't matter to you, cause aren't you the one? Oh, with your rats and the ties and the knives on the town.
I mean, that's a great song.
Yeah, it's really, it's a new Pulp. And it's still beloved. And I read online that in an NME poll, readers ranked it as the fourth best Pulp song.
Oh, really?
I don't know how I'd rank it, but it's classic, kind of his bitchy attitude about people. I guess it was inspired by an ex-girlfriend. And I read online that they did meet up again later and kind of laughed about it. She didn't take it too badly.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah, it's great. And apparently it was their highest rated single at the time. It hit number 80 on whatever British charts.
I like these stories of bands that stick around for a long time and then finally make it. Because so many stories are like, band comes out, first album's a big success, and then they never quite hit that peak again. So I really like to hear when bands are hardworking and they keep doing it and keep doing it. And then finally the success comes.
Yeah. And how weird is it? There's so many bands that say like Weezer that they put out their masterpieces up front and they peter out. I mean, it's almost common, right? That people don't have longevity, but these guys, 10 years into their career, they hit a next level of artistry.
Yeah.
That's so rare. And so good thing they stuck to it.
Right. Part of the change in direction here is that they finally solidified their classic lineup just prior to this, I think, with Countdown. And so it's a slightly different sounding band. They're definitely more like dance oriented. But also Jarvis Cocker seems to have moved lyrically into writing more specific lyrics, I think. So like a lot of his earlier lyrics, I think they're fine, but they seem you know, to use a lot of generalities, nothing specifically stands out as like, this guy's an amazing lyricist. But at this point, he's providing all these details. He's telling the story and you just can't help but get drawn into it. Did Babies precede this one? I think it might have, but no one actually heard it.
It did, and then it was re-recorded.
Yeah, okay.
But it was a gift single.
Yeah. So I think with Babies and Razzmatazz, suddenly like he's telling these tales of like not just love and longing, but like, oh, there's this girl and her name is this, and here's exactly what I did, and here's what she was doing at the time. And
no, I agree. The specificity in his lyrics is part of their charm, for sure.
Yeah, but I don't know what to say other than this is a great one, and Pulp has a lot of great singles to come. This is just the beginning of them hitting their stride, and they're not gonna release bad singles ever after this point. I'm not sure. It's just one good song after the next.
I think that's fair to say.
Okay, well, cool. Thanks for bringing Pulp to the table. Let's talk about another band that was around for quite a while, but in this case, they were around even earlier, and they broke up, and I think the world more or less forgot about them and thought they were gone for good, and in 1993, they reappeared. Longtime listeners will know this is one of my favorite bands of all time. We're talking about Buzzcocks. They're one of the best bands of the first wave of UK punk, led by Pete Shelley and Steve Diggle. And after releasing three albums and some singles, they broke up in 1981, but returned in the early 90s. And in 1993, they released their first album in 13 or 14 years, and it was called Trade Test Transmissions. Let's listen to a single off of this. This is called Innocent. To me, that's quite a comeback single. I don't think it's mind-boggling, but I think it's really high quality and more than most of us probably could have expected after such a long hiatus. It's throwbacky in a very rock and roll kind of way, but it's filtered through kind of a noisy punk, and it has enough of like a slightly off-kilter, arty edge to it to make it stand out as being Buzzcocks.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. To me, it sounded like the Monkees. And I love the Monkees, but very poppy, very catchy. And Will's so sweet. He's tried hard to get me in the Buzzcocks, and I do like them. He gave me an album of theirs, but I don't have too much of an emotional connection. So I'm wondering, what's the number one thing that draws you to them, especially if you could say on an emotional level?
Gosh. I think I just love the energy of early punk music.
Yeah.
To me, what connects is like that combination of pop and punk. And I think Buzzcocks do it better than just about anybody.
There's some bands, I mean, that like the Monkees, they give me joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be enough, just the catchiness, the spirit. But as someone who's slow to absorb lyrics and a little less obsessed with punk, I'm not like crushing over Buzzcocks. But, you know, I love their best of. I mean, don't get me wrong, I really respect them, but I'm just curious.
Okay. Well, I mean, you'll come around.
I'm going to get there.
Yeah. I think this song is maybe not production-wise, but I think as a song, it could be slipped into singles going steady and replace another song.
Yeah.
And fit in perfectly well. And in fact, I think this album, I don't want to say it's a great album because it's got a lot of filler. There's a lot of stuff on there that could definitely be cut, but there's a lot of really strong, fun pop punk songs on here. Also, I think it's worth noting that, you know, this pop punk explosion from England that happened in like the late 70s never happened in America. Well, hadn't happened yet in America. And we're just about on the verge of that, you know, 1993, end of 1993. Green Day It's coming, what, 95? They're going to explode. The Offspring are coming. Bad Religion has been doing their thing for a while, and they're going to be hitting some mainstream success pretty soon.
Yeah, you're really spot on there. I think this song we just heard is a real precursor of and hint of what's to come. So tribute to Buzzcocks for being ahead of the curve.
Yeah. And of course, Buzzcocks, you know, the reunion actually lasts for quite a while. They stick around. They put out a bunch more albums. And unfortunately, Pete Shelley died, I don't know, 5 years ago, maybe at this point. Steve Diggle carried on without him, which is a questionable choice.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right. Well, that was fun. Let's jump back to you. What are we going to hear from next?
Maybe let's listen to my most left field pick, so okay, we don't end on a downer.
Sure.
This is an artist that is pretty well renowned on indie levels and musician circles, but I think maybe is left field for the modern rock audience. The single is by Palace Brothers, but that's really this singer-songwriter, Will Oldham, who's from Louisville, Kentucky. And he's most famous now under the moniker Bonnie Prince Billy.
Mm-hmm.
But 93 was his origin year as a recording artist, and he put out this debut single we're going to listen to, and then followed it up with his debut album, all under the Palace Brothers moniker. And I learned about him in college around 98, I guess, and he became my favorite artist for a decade. And I used to have a 3-disc CD player, and I always had to have one Will Oldham CD in it at all times. And I would shuffle through that. So it was a real obsession. I think his music is rock, but it's also country, it's folk, it's kind of Southern Gothic, Appalachian folk. It's lo-fi, especially in the beginning of his career, and I think the lo-fi parallels a lot of the lo-fi movement. He came out on Drag City, based out of Chicago, and they put out other lo-fi artists like Early Pavement or Early Smog. So I'd love to hear his debut single, and I can go on indefinitely about it.
Okay, well, let's listen to it. What's this one called?
Ohio Riverboat Song.
Okay. Very nice.
Yeah. Before we talk about the song, do you mind if I expand a little on his bio here?
Go for it.
He actually started out as a teenage actor.
Oh.
He was had a lead supporting role in a John Sayles film, Matewan, about a historical coal mining strike. He, as a young man, played the role of Chip McClure in the Jessica McClure story TV movie, which is Baby Jessica in the Well.
Okay.
He continues to act, but he decided that wasn't a career for him, so he just acts in Friends. He was in Old Joy by Kelly Reichardt and a really good A24 film called A Ghost Story. He played a good role in there.
I saw Old Joy.
Yeah.
Not familiar with the other one.
Ugh. He's kind of just almost like a Zelig-esque Forrest Gump guy that appears in all these places. He was in a Kanye West video before Kanye went off the rails, with Zach Galifianakis.
Okay.
Can't Tell Me Nothing. He's recorded with Bjork. He's recorded with Chris Vrenna from Nine Inch Nails. He took the photo of the album cover for Slint's Spiderland album.
Really?
Another one of his weird appearances was in one of R. Kelly's Trapped in the Closet videos.
That's really weird.
I don't know how he ends up in these places.
What was he doing? Was he in the closet?
You know, I never got into R. Kelly, and now I really am not into him, so I haven't watched it.
Yeah. That was a really long song, right? That was like 17
songs. Well, there was
songs,
eight or so videos.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe even longer than I'm remembering. Maybe like, was that like a feature length?
I think the whole thing is about 40 minutes.
Wow.
Long. I don't know, pretty long.
Okay.
So he's everywhere and just pretty really well-respected guy. And he's recorded under like 5 or 6 monikers. Bonnie Prince Billy is the main one these days, but it was the first artist I ever encountered that changed their band name all the time.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so fun to track down these secret releases. He put out an album that was transitional in his mind, so he dropped the Palace moniker and just put no band name on it.
Oh, okay.
How do you know who that is?
Yeah.
You just look at this album title and you somehow figure it out. And this is in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, internet existed, but it wasn't so easy these days.
Right.
Going back to the song itself, this is his first single. It was later collected on a compilation called Lost Blues and Other Songs by Palace Music. But it was a 7-inch single for Palace Brothers. He does record with his brothers, especially then. His two brothers are very talented musicians and have done their own solo music. But for all intents and purposes, all his music is a solo or collaborative effort with rotating musicians. And Ohio Riverboat Song, even though he's a songwriter, is actually an adaptation of a Scottish folk song.
Okay.
This song is so big in his oeuvre, it's on his greatest hits, which he re-recorded because he's against greatest hits. He does like a super slick kind of 70s country version on there. And then he recently re-recorded it for his career retrospective. They put out a book of his lyrics called Songs of Love and Horror. And he recorded some of his classics and recorded on there. And that's a folk version. He's a great reinterpreter of his songs, just like Dylan is. And this is a song that stuck with him in it throughout his career.
Cool. If I'm not mistaken, 93 is also the year that Uncle Tupelo put out their final album.
That sounds about right. Anodyne.
Yeah. So, and you know, maybe a year after Jayhawks put out maybe their best album. So there's something happening in kind of the Americana alternative country.
You know, and I think all subgenre. Those artists have a Chicago connection.
Really? Interesting.
Tupelo does at least, and Bonnie Prince Billy.
But as I was listening, it sort of brought to mind some bands that are kind of Americana or kind of drawing on similar inspirations, but actually had some mainstream success a decade or two down the line. So, you know, Mumford and Sons and the Lumineers and some other bands like that.
Oh, that reminds me, the weirdest recent Will Oldham thing is he co-wrote a bunch of songs for John Legend.
Oh, really?
I have that album, Darkness and Light. John Legend's fine. I'm not a big fan, but you know, that's obviously mainstream music.
Mm-hmm.
And they're co-written by Will Oldham here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's weird.
It's a weird one.
All right. Well, cool. Let's keep going.
Sounds good.
I'm going to play a song by an English band called Swerve Driver. They're originally from Oxford and they formed in 1989. And I guess they're kind of a shoegaze band, but when I think shoegaze, I tend to think swirly guitars and maybe some light, wispy vocals. And this is a much heavier brand of shoegaze. This is maybe like shoegaze slash grunge at the same time. Swerve Driver released the album Mezcal Head in 1993. And we're going to listen to the first single off the album, which is called Duel. Here it is.
But tell us about Swerve Driver.
I mean, I don't think I have anything particularly interesting to say about Swerve Driver as a band. I just wanted to hear some heavier rock music on this episode. So I picked this song because I thought it was a good song. And Mezcal Head, the album it's from, is a really strong album. I think it's interesting that even though shoegaze was a pretty popular genre or subgenre in England at the time, a Swerve Driver, not a particularly popular band over there. And this album has, I think, really stuck around. It gets critical acclaim and it gets brought up in, you know, best album lists still, but didn't sell very well, which, you know, I think some grunge bands did fine in the UK, but British grunge bands or grunge leaning bands did not seem to capture any success over there for whatever reason.
Yeah, it did sound very grunge to me. I mean, I believe it's acclaimed. I liked it fine. but what makes them stand out? To me, it was kind of typical of my memory of that era.
You mean versus other grunge stuff? It's got like the heavy grunge sound, sort of, but it's also like swirlier. It's got like some dream pop elements to it.
Some more unique production, maybe.
Yeah, it's less. I think it's less focused on sing-along choruses and probably less focused on personal angst as well. I know that's a big topic in grunge songs, although, of course, not all of them were about that. Now, one other thing is that their follow-up album to Mezcal Head is supposed to be really good, maybe their best album. I have not heard it, and I don't think too many people have actually heard it, because it's one of those albums that got sort of lost in the shuffle, where they had it ready to go, and their American record label just decided not to release it because they had too many other things that they wanted to release at the time, so they put it off for like a year, and then because they weren't getting an American release, their British label also decided to drop them. You know, eventually it did come out, and they, you know, kept going as a band for a while and released more albums. But yeah, it is one of those cases where what's possibly their best work just did not get any kind of play or notice or publicity. And
yeah, it's tragic. It's so frustrating how glib major labels could be with people's careers.
Yeah.
You hear those stories all the time. You're like, why?
All right. Well, where are we going next, Jeremy?
Well, sensitive listeners may want to cover their ears, hide your kids, hide your daughters, because we're going to talk about Liz Phair and her iconic song, Fuck and Run.
Oh, F word and run, yes.
Yes, F beep and run.
Okay, yes. Tell us about it.
I think this is her most iconic song, or at least amongst her original fans. Mm-hmm. We did a little Spotify challenge to see if I was right, and it was the second highest stream, but way behind her Matrix co-written pop single from later in her career. But it's from her debut album, Exile in Guyville, which came out in 93. Liz Phair is another Chicago-based artist. It's on Matador Records. She was born in Connecticut, but grew up in Chicago. The album is supposedly a song-by-song retort to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. That gets a lot of coverage sometimes. I don't personally find it that interesting. I like the other album, and I think it's a good marketing pitch, and even clever on her part to put the somewhat chauvinist Stones as foils to her music. But have I ever once tried to compare them song by song? I don't care. The songs stand on their own. They're good songs. The music itself is very spare in general, kind of no frills. And her vocals feel unprocessed, unrehearsed in a good sense, and very natural. And she has kind of a husky voice, and it really presents kind of this authentic person. That being said, the lyrics for this are pretty controversial, or maybe just scandalous. And I read that almost none of these songs are actually about her life.
Okay.
So think of her, you know, really she's a songwriter. She's creating ideas and image. I think the songs represent her in the terms of her willingness to provoke, and they represent her personality, but not her biography.
Mm-hmm.
There's many great songs I had trouble picking, but really this one is just so iconic and so catchy, and the lyrics are interesting, provocative, so.
And this is an album that frequently ends up on best of lists.
Yeah. Here's some of the accolades for Exile in Guyville.
Mm-hmm.
1993, Paz and Jop, first best album of the year. Paste ranked it 41 best album of the 90s. Pitchfork ranked it fourth best album of the 90s. Rolling Stone, 6th best concept albums. Rolling Stone from a 2020 list, 20th best album of the 90s. Rolling Stone, 56th best album of all time.
Wow.
Slant, 4th best album of 93, and Spin, the best album of 93.
Wow, yeah.
I think her career continued to be good, but it was kind of met by disappointment, album after album. And I can't group myself in there because I learned about her when I was 20 or 19. But fans of her when she came out had built an image up, and they wanted her to put out music along this image, and she changed so much they couldn't handle it.
Yeah. The thing about this album is that it's so full of so many good songs, and so tons of songs could have been picked as a single. As it turns out, none of them were released as singles, as far as I know. There were a couple music videos made for Stratford-on-Guy and Never Said, So it's interesting that, you know, Fuckin' Run is such an iconic song in her discography because, you know, it wasn't a single. So yeah, just lots and lots of good stuff here. Definitely an album worth checking out. But enough of that. Let's listen to it. Here's Liz Phair with Fuckin' Run. That brought back some memories for me.
Yeah, of your wild youth.
No. I mean, I like what, probably 6 or 7 years after this album came out, you know, and I was rocking it pretty heavily. And I remember being somewhat scandalized there by the lyrics, especially even when I was 12. You know, I'd be singing along to the song and get to that part, like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it was a joy to listen to it. It touches so many pleasure centers in my brain. It's kind of funny in a dark humor way. It's also sad, but it's also kind of fearless in a more of a punk rock way. It just is so many emotions in it to me that I feel listening to it. I really admire her for making such a unique song, and I love it.
I also appreciate, not just on this song, but other songs of hers too from this album, she's dealing with sex in a way that I don't think very many other artists were, as if it's a, you know, it's a matter of fact part of life rather than as something titillating and something to be using as a marketing ploy, perhaps.
Yeah, no, well put. I mean, that song is about sex in many ways, but you don't put it on for lovemaking. It's not supposed to be sexy. It doesn't touch any of the main things that your average song about sex does.
And even, you know, if you look at the cover of the album, you can see a little areola there, a little nip slip going on. But it's like, it doesn't seem sexually provocative in a way that I see on a lot of other album covers. It's just like this in your face, so what, here I am kind of picture.
I doubt she ever hits the charts except for the pop songs. But are you going to revisit her? I don't think you will, unless it's a Bubbling Under.
Liz Phair is going to chart twice.
Oh, good.
1994, she'll chart with Supernova. And in 95, she charts with Whip Smart.
All right. Well, I hope we get to hear more.
I think we probably will. I think we'll probably hear Supernova when it comes around.
Can I just point out, just for my own nerdiness, that I picked all P artists from the P part of my alphabet? Mm-hmm. So maybe that just shows how rich there's 25 other letters unexplored by me.
Yeah.
From that year.
We should do 25 more episodes of Bubbling Under.
Let's just do an alphabet theme from now on.
Yeah, go through the alphabet. You pick an A, I'll pick a B, yeah. So on. All right, well, I think we've got one more to listen to.
Oh, good.
I got to say, I had such a hard time making choices here. I pulled up lists of what came out in 93 and looked through my own personal collection, and there's just a lot of really good music. Bands like The Auteurs and The Loud Family and Slow Wave came out with their most acclaimed album this year.
I was tempted to talk about Yola Tango, Smog, BMX Bandits. But yeah, I had like 4 or 5 other top choices.
It was tough making those choices, you know, and like I said, some of them I just cut because I thought that stylistically they were too similar to some other ones we heard. But I'm going to play a song by a band called Archers of Loaf. This is a band that every time I mention it to my wife, she just goes, yuck, that's the worst band name I've ever heard. It makes me think of poop.
Same.
Yeah.
Definitely the same. I can't pretend I know the band well, although I've always heard of them.
Yeah, I think I've probably mentioned them to you in the past. I think I recall saying like, well, you know, it's not they're not the same, but you're a really big Pavement fan. I feel like if you enjoy Pavement, you could probably enjoy Archers of Loaf. And I think you said something about your wife telling you to stay far away.
Probably.
Yeah. It makes sense to me that wives would not love Archers of Loaf. But I think they're pretty great. This is a band that was formed in Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1991. And in 1993, they released their first full-length album called Icky Metal. So we're going to hear one of their most well-known songs. It's a single from the album, and it's called Web in Front. Here it is.
That was fun. I did like that.
Yeah, I thought you would. Pitchfork Media named that one of the 500 best songs of recent decades.
Whatever that means. Oh, good old recent decades.
I just read that on Wikipedia.
Huh. Are they still going?
Yeah, they broke up in the late 90s. They got back together in 2011, and they're still doing it. They released a single in 2022.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
There was a subset of alternative singles in that era that were kind of little yelpy and kind of spiky. I'm trying to figure out how to describe this, but it wasn't like the heaviness of grunge. It wasn't trying to be Britpop. They were kind of like a nerd doing grunge or something.
Sure.
But I like a lot of those singles, and it throws me back. It really felt like high school to me in a good way.
Yeah. Now, just for fun, I'm going to play a clip from another Archers of Loaf song, which is the first Archers of Loaf song I ever heard.
Okay.
And the reason I'm playing it is because it's very, very different. This is a song called White Trash Heroes, and it came from their album of the same name, which they released in 1998. And as you're going to hear it, they went in a very different direction. I heard this song on a mix CD that I think my sister made for me back when I was in college. And this is my impression of Archers of Loaf for the longest time until I got my hands on a copy of Icky Metal.
Hmm.
So here it is. What would you call that? Like post-grunge electro-goth?
I'd call it Crash Test Dummies meets Erasure.
Okay, yeah.
I actually liked it though, but that voice was very different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird.
Weird indeed.
Well, kudos to bands that evolve.
Yeah.
Even if it's for the worse.
I mean, I still think that's a cool song.
I like it. I don't know.
But it's very different indeed. All right. Well, that's our songs, I think. Did we miss anything? Did we get them all?
Oh, definitely got every good song. We didn't miss any good songs. Listeners, rest assured.
Sweet. Okay. Well, thanks for coming down, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I heard some new songs I didn't know.
Same.
Got some new stuff to check out, or I guess some old stuff to check out. And I hope listeners enjoyed it. I hope listeners heard some things they didn't know that they also want to go check out. If they want some more recommendations of some obscure stuff from 1993, I'm sure they can write in and I'll give them a big old list. Jeremy, you can contribute some thoughts too.
Sure.
So if anyone wants to do that, you can reach out to me at thisismodernrock@gmail.com. Well, we got one more episode for the season. We're going to do the 1993 season wrap up and then that'll be it until 94.
All right. Thanks, Will.
Yeah. Well, let's go out on one last song. Jeremy, do you have something you want to suggest?
Yeah, why don't we listen to The Muffs? I know we were both fans of the band, and I miss Kim Shattuck. I'd love to hear a song.
Yeah, that sounds great. So they released their self-titled album in 1993, is that right?
Yep.
What song do you want to hear?
Lucky Guy.
Okay, here we go. Have a good one. Here's the Muffs with Lucky Guy. Testing. Is this recording? No, apparently it's not. Oh, there it is. Yeah.